So I call this one Two Big Surprises. But there's maybe a few more. I don't know. We'll see how we go. But I want to take a fresh look at Jesus' arrival today. To set this into context, and again, if you weren't here last week, that's not a problem. But just so you know where we've come from, last week we started our journey through the Gospel of Matthew, and it's going to take us however long it takes us. Then that's okay. If we're still here by Christmas, then maybe we'll just be in the right place. But Matthew starts off, as you remember last week, those of you who were here, with this amazing genealogy, which most of us have no idea what to do with. And it's the one reading, as Don testifies to, it's the one reading you never want the pastor to say, would you read this for me next Sunday? Because there's a lot of names. There's a lot of names. And not names that we would be familiar with, but I actually think he did an exceptional job. Don Clann. And one of the things we learned as we looked through the genealogy was really Matthew was making two bold statements. The first bold statement he made was that this baby, and you know this stuff really well, this baby was connected to a royal line. And more than that, was connected to the biggest promise from God that one day, all would be made well. And as we went through the genealogy, we explored what it looked like to be Abraham and receive that promise of blessing through his through his line. And then we heard about the word to Judah and then to David. And we looked at how Matthew deliberately connects Jesus with these people and establishes very, very clearly, this is the one. But the other thing we looked at last week was that Matthew also deliberately puts in some very surprising names. He doesn't invent them, but they're the kind of names where if you had these people in your family tree, you would probably not want to talk about them very much. And these mostly were women. And it's not because they were women, but they were particular women who had been caught up in some very, very difficult circumstances. And we had Rahab the prostitute, and we had Tamar who managed to sleep with her father-in-law. It's very, very complicated. Right? And we even had Uriah's wife, which was Bathsheba, who was taken and abused by King David, who was supposed to know better. And we even had Mary, teenage Mary, who, as we'll discover today, was the subject of a scandal. Because it was not a good place to be in first century Israel, to be young, betrothed, and pregnant. So Matthew puts all these details in, and he reminds us in that one, and remember, Matthew was this tax collector who had sort of given up on his people and had gone to the other side and was making the living, the best living that he could for himself by ripping off his own people. And so he knew also what it was to be shunned and discarded and isolated and demonized, right? And so you can imagine Matthew, who has received this incredible welcome from Jesus, who doesn't just say, I'm going to forgive you, but he says, I'm going to appoint you to be one of my central 12. That when he comes to write this story 30 or so years after Jesus had died and risen and ascended, as he puts his pen to paper, you can imagine him saying it's really important that these people know that Jesus doesn't just come for the kings, but he comes for the screw-ups and the broken and the discarded. And more importantly, in the genealogy, he comes from those people too. Yeah? So that means that this playing field is suddenly open to all of us, because you don't have to be a king to be accepted. You don't have to have it all together and have the right line and hereditary, all that nonsense, to be accepted by God. So that's where we got to last week. Now today, we're going to look at Joseph and Mary. And again, this is so familiar. And I was like, oh Lord, how do we share this fresh? And I'll do my best, and you can give me feedback afterwards. But as we go, I want you to keep a lookout for these themes, because they're not always the themes. I think sometimes when we read these passages at Christmas, we know what we're supposed to say, right? This is really, and if you're my kids, this is really a way of, you have to get through all these wretched stories before we get to the presents and the turkey, okay? So it's just like, yes, we'll go through this. Right, where's the presents? And we can actually miss what's going on. So as we go through this, have a listen out for these themes. First theme is God has a plan. It's a plan that he made a really long time ago. And sometimes God's plans are made a long time ago and take a long time to come to fruition, but it doesn't escape the fact that God has a plan. That's theme one. Theme two, God decides the timing of his plan. Yeah? Number three, God calls us to long for his plan to come. Okay? Number four, this is the last theme, we need to be prepared for the unexpected. And that he wants to use people like you, ordinary you and me, screw up or otherwise, he wants to use us not just to long for his plan, but to work with him in bringing his plan to action. That's what we're getting from this story. Are you ready? All right, let's go. So let's set the scene. The place, can I have my first slide? Next one. Thank you. Okay, so I didn't know this really because my biblical geography is awful. It's non-existent, honestly. But I looked in it and I was aware that Nazareth had something of a kind of about it to most other people in Israel. There's a brilliant moment where in John 1, when Nathanael is called to come and meet this guy from Nazareth, this is what he says. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? Right? Now, the funny thing for me, and you won't get this joke, but I'm going to give it to you anyway, is that in England, those of us in the south mock the people who come from the north. All right? And you've got a little bit of this here, that the people around Jerusalem and Bethlehem and Bethany and all those good places, they're like, Nazareth? Isn't that somewhere north? The big controversy is that I married a northerner. And then I discovered something, that the north is actually better than the south. And the northerners perpetuate the myth that it's awful, so the southerners don't come. So there's a little bit of British social geography for you. So that's where the scene is set. It's a forgettable place. In a nowheresville kind of area. It's insignificant. It's forgotten. It's bypassed. I don't know if Gibson's felt like that in years gone by. I don't think it feels like that so much anymore because everyone has realized that you guys are really onto something and everyone's coming out here to try and live. But I wonder if you know what it is to come from a place that doesn't feel significant. And it's interesting when we read watch our news that the news is formed by people who live in significant places and are full of their importance. And one of the themes in British news media actually for a long time was that it was very London-centric. Even the news that was broadcast about the rest of the country was written and broadcast by people who live in London. And so you've got this idea that we are in this place that isn't obvious for something that is going to change the entire course of history to happen. Surely it would happen in somewhere significant, at least in Jerusalem, but actually better if it was Rome or somewhere fancy. In our day and age, it might be, well, surely not Gibson's, maybe Vancouver, or perhaps Toronto. I can't say that, Toronto. Maybe New York, maybe London. But before the beginning of time, God had this plan that Nowheresville was going to be the center of everything. Okay? Now, to bring this to sort of ground, can I have the next visual, please? to make this point that they say history is often written by the victors, the powerful, the rich, the people who've got it all together. In my country, there are a lot of England, there are a lot of these famous old houses where worthy, important people have lived. And this, I don't know, it looks particularly impressive, actually, but this was the house that Winston Churchill lived in when he was resident in London when he was not Prime Minister. And can you see there's that little blue round circle next to the window there? If we note the next slide, please. This is what it says. And you'll have these all over the place in across the UK, that wherever somebody was famous lived, we stick one of these on the wall to tell you about it, okay? And actually, if you want to go and do a good tour of the UK and explore our history, do a blue circle tour and just go and see where these people lived, right? Now, this is the reason I show you this is to just emphasize the Nowheresville nature of this place. We used to live in a little village just outside of Oxford, the city of Oxford, on the River Thames floodplains. And my parents at the time lived 3 miles down the road in a little village called Standlake, which is really not very famous for anything at all. It's a kind of Nazareth, a kind of Nowheresville. And this was brought home to me because one of their neighbors had a plaque stuck up on their driveway which said this. Next slide, please. I always appreciated that sort of dry humor. Okay, so that's the place. And what about the time? Well, I imagine, and I'm putting a little bit of my imagination into this. I hope that's okay. I imagine that this story unfolds in an ordinary place on just another ordinary day. Another ordinary day in a forgotten place. It's kind of hot and dusty. It's another day under Roman occupation that shows no sign of going anywhere. It's another day of noise and bustle and daily life and people trying to make do as best they could under extremely hard circumstances. It was just another one of those days. And remember, too, at this time that it had been 400 years, according to the Bible narrative, it had been 400 years since God had spoken to his people. And this is a people who, as we said before, were defined by being the people whom God spoke to. But for 400 years, that's like us going back to 1624, God hadn't spoken. Can you imagine how different it would be for us if we're like, well, we're still waiting for Jesus and God hasn't spoken since 1624. Do you have a familial memory back to 1624? I don't. So it's a really long time. It's actually this is a nerdy moment. It's 146,000 days if you're interested. Not exactly. So it's just nowhere and nothing and ordinary and predictable. And as far as we're told, there was no magic in the air. There was no solar eclipse. See, that's a timely reference. If you're watching this in a year's time, go check the news. There were no lights in the sky, right? It was just another day. God works amazing things in just ordinary days and in forgettable places. And I would put it to you that he prefers to do amazing things with ordinary people in ordinary time, in ordinary places. The way the world works is we have pomp and circumstance and pageantry and wealth and grandioseness and capital cities. But it's the kingdom's good pleasure, because it's the king's good pleasure, to break through in ordinariness. So don't ever think that because of who you are, where you've come from, or where you live, or what the time is, that you're out of the grip of God's work. In fact, it could be that because you're on the margins, because you're on the edge, because you're somewhere that is forgotten, if you feel forgotten, that may just place you in the center of God's purpose. So be encouraged. And so the people who are living in this ordinary time and place, two people emerge in our chapter today. Mary, likely, as you know, this is the scandalous bit. She's probably 13 or 14. And in that, thank you. And in that, true story, Jean said, I could ask Don to sit up there so that when I'm needed for the last hymn, she's doing Sunday school right now, he could pop in. I said, don't move Don from the first row. I need Don. I really do. Be more like Don. It really helps preachers, by the way, if you're getting encouragement from the pews. But anyway, Mary, likely, thank you, Don, bless you, likely a 13 or 14-year-old girl. And that's pretty shocking to us, and I'm not here to defend that, but it was a practice of the time. And you hear this idea that she was betrothed, and I didn't really know what that meant. I was like, does that mean she was engaged? And what I've read is that it means a lot more than that. It's almost like all the legal bit is done. They're as good as married, and all that's required now is for him to take her home, if you see what I mean. Literally home and then literally home, right? So that's the bit that hasn't been done yet, but everything else, legally, she is as good as his wife. And she's 13 or 14, which means that she hasn't been married to anyone before. Really important point. Now, I wonder if you just stop a second before the story rushes away with you, because we know what's coming and it's good. I wonder what Mary must have been feeling. Have you ever stopped long enough to ask that question? And as a middle-aged man, I truly don't know what it would be like to be a teenager and a young woman betrothed to be married. Forget about the pregnancy bit, that's coming. But she's probably what? Excited? Scared? Nervous? I mean, this is what happens in her culture, so it's probably not a surprise. But nonetheless, you're leaving your parents' house and you're suddenly becoming a woman and a wife in one day kind of thing. It must have been quite a moment. And then, amidst all of this, something truly unexpected happens. Suddenly the everydayness and the predictability and the monotony of daily life is shattered because you're Mary. And try and imagine that moment where you realize that you are pregnant. Can you imagine what that must have felt like? Matthew calms us at this point. It's almost like he's like, yeah, chill, it's okay. God's got this. And he adds in verse 18, Mary is pregnant through the Holy Spirit. But there's no other indication from Matthew that Mary actually knew that at the time. Can you imagine the tension in the room? And this is a little bit of imaginative poetic license, but the whisper shouts, the kind of, I can't believe you've done it. Can you imagine that? Mary talking to her mum and then to her dad. And then like, you've got to go and tell him. You've got to go and tell Joseph. Imagine the fear in the room. This isn't supposed to happen. And interestingly, Luke, who's the only other gospel writer who mentions this early stage of Jesus' life, does say, he portrays quite a different account. He talks about the angel coming to Mary and said, do not be afraid, this is going to happen to you. And then Mary doing this beautiful hymn, this song of Mary that you should read sometime, where she accepts it and says, may it be to me as you have said. And there's no mention of Joseph's plan. But again, remember that each gospel writer isn't trying to do a diary of what happened every day of Jesus' life. They're taking like little, imagine patchwork, are there any quilters among us? Patchwork quilt makers? Yes, I see your hands at the back. So you know what it's like, you get your patches and you select some and you discard others before you decide what pattern to put them in. It almost sounds like I know what I'm talking about. And each gospel writer is a bit like the patchwork quilt ladies, right? They take different patches and they leave others out and they rearrange sometimes the timing of it, not because they're trying to tell lies, but because they're trying to make a specific point. Now remember that Matthew had just established, as we said, Jesus' ancestry. It was royal and it was messed up. It was very ordinary too. And so Joseph now enters the story with all of this having gone on, that Mary is pregnant and the family are terrified, I imagine, because of scandal. Now, what do we know about Joseph? Well, we know he was a carpenter because it said later on, Matthew tells us later on that he was a carpenter. Well, Jesus was the son of the carpenter. And Matthew also gives us the detail. He was faithful to the law. That meant he kind of knew what was expected and he knew how this kind of thing could play out. Being pregnant whilst betrothed was a huge, huge deal. Because the pregnancy is evidence in that time of adultery. And if you were caught as an adulterer, particularly as a betrothed adulterer, you would be sent to trial and you could very easily be condemned to death by stoning, because that was the Old Testament law in Deuteronomy. If you look into Deuteronomy, it says you will take both the man and the woman, interestingly, if you know who they are, and go and stone them outside the city. Now, it didn't always work out that way, but that was the ultimate threat. So you can imagine this reality going around Joseph's mind as well. And even if she had survived and not been sentenced to death, the likelihood was that she would have been socially excluded and outcast for the rest of her life. The law would have required, or the society would have required, that the family would push her out. So imagine that as your teenage Mary self, or as your Joseph self who is trying to be faithful to the law. And Joseph know what the law requires, but then Matthew uses two brilliant, brilliant words. I wonder if this is the first or the second expression of grace in Matthew. The first expression is the inclusion of the screw-ups in the genealogy. And he says, and yet. Joseph knew what was required, and yet. And yet he did not want to expose her to public disgrace. Joseph knew what could happen, but he wasn't just a man of law. He was a man of compassion and of great character, I think. And so it says he made a plan to divorce her quietly. Okay. So far, so good? All right. So it's proving that even though we're in an ordinary, forgotten place, and this started as an ordinary day, it's not an ordinary day any longer. Maybe, though, it's just a blip in the timeline of ordinariness. And that's often the way with scandal, isn't it? That it comes and then we hush it up, we'll deal with it. Everyone breathes a sigh of relief that that's sorted. Now we can get back to the mundanity of our daily life. A scandal averted, perhaps, thanks to Joseph's kindness. But then the real first surprise happens. God speaks through an angel in a dream. Now again, we're so familiar with this moment, but just stop for a second. God didn't do that sort of thing in those days and hadn't done so, as far as we know, for 400 years. So imagine Joseph, right? I imagine he's tired because stressful, scandalous, difficult relational kind of stuff is exhausting. If you've been through it, you know, right? Whatever your issue has been, you know that if somebody's very sick or there's a problem in your family, it is exhausting in its own way. So I imagine him heading to bed after this kind of emotional roller coaster of recent days, and he goes to sleep, having decided on his course of action. to divorce Mary quietly. And then he has this dream. But I imagine, and again, this is a little bit of imaginative license, but go with me. I imagine it to be so clear, so vivid, unlike most dreams, which actually, you remember you had the dream, but you cannot remember what the dream was about. I imagine this must have been something where he sits up in his bed and goes, whoa, what just happened? Joseph had a dream that people around the world will talk and wonder about for the rest of time. That's the dream he had. And he sees an angel, and the angel says something completely unexpected. I didn't give you notice of this, visual people, but could you get Matthew 1, verses 20 and 21 back for me? Sorry, I should have given you this. So after he considered this, an angel of the Lord appeared and said, Joseph, son of David, don't be afraid to take Mary home as your wife, because what's conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. Right, next verse. She will give birth to a son, and you're to give him the name Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins. We're so familiar with it, you don't... What has he just said? This is... Mic drop moment. I don't know if you... That's a cultural reference most of you will get. My kids tell me this. You say something cool, and then you... It's like you've got nothing more to say. Everything that has been said about this topic has been said. You drop the mic and you walk off to cheers. Like, it's almost that sense. This had never happened in Nazareth or nowhere else. Two big ideas, right? God made your wife to be pregnant. Said God never before this point, but says God now. And second thing, this child will revolutionize the way people relate to God. He will forgive their people of their sins. This is a big reference to the Jewish culture. Only God forgives. Every Jewish person knew that. And he does it through temple sacrifice that has been mediated by priests. And it's been that way for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And he says, God's made a baby, and this baby is going to change the way people get right with God. No mention of priests and temples and of lambs and sacrifices. He's going to do it somehow. He doesn't say how. Notice that? I'm not going to tell you how yet, because we're going to give it. God gives it just a little bit away at a time, right? Keeps you wondering. And then Joseph wakes up. Can you imagine what's going through his head? Now, I wonder, if that had been you, how would you have responded? How would you have felt if you were Joseph? Even today, let me ask you, have you ever had a God dream like that? I wonder if Joseph was like, did I eat some funny cheese last? Like, what is this overactive imagination? Because remember that if he had repeated what the dream said, he would be articulating heresy in that culture. There was a risk to Joseph for sharing his dream. Another scandal is suddenly on the doorstep. And it would be a scandal because it would threaten the religious status quo and the power balance. And we know that's a big threat because, as we'll see in a week or two's time, Herod gets very, very upset by this news. But somehow, and we're not told how, Joseph knew that this wasn't imagination, that this was God. So he must have shared it with others, and we know that because we're reading it today, and the only way that would have happened is if he told Matthew. Does that make sense? But more than that, he didn't just talk about the dream, he obeyed the dream. Matthew senses our anxiety at this point and interrupts the story to remind us that what had been shared in the dream did actually have scriptural precedent. Now go with this. 700 years before, God knew about this and told Isaiah, the virgin shall be with child and they shall call his name Emmanuel. 700 years before, God got excited enough to tell somebody, but not enough that people would necessarily remember when it happened in Nowheresville 700 years later. Have we got that on the screen? Yeah, there you go. I'll give you a sign. The virgin shall conceive and give birth to a son and call him Emmanuel. I think it's like that, isn't it? That we long for something to shift or to change. And we pray, and maybe you will relate to this. You're praying for years about something that is very dear to your heart. Maybe it's a loved one that you want to come to faith, or perhaps it's somebody who's suffering with great sickness and you wish that healing would come. Or perhaps it's a grandchild who's heading off in the wrong direction. Or maybe your heart is burdened for a place or a particular group of people, and you're like, come, Lord Jesus. And nothing seems to happen. Remember, Isaiah prophesies, and 700 years go by with seemingly nothing happening. It's been thousands of days of not yet, but then one day, one day God says, now. And there is nothing that can stop God's now. Not the Roman Empire, not cultural tradition, not the forgotten nature of who they were or where they lived. Nothing could stop God's now. So God speaks and Joseph hears, and Joseph obeys and he acts, doing what the angel commanded him, and he takes Mary home to be his wife, and he respects a holy state. And then when the child is born, he does, I think this is remarkable, we miss this detail too, that it was usually the father, sometimes the mother, but particularly the father's job in that culture to name the child. And God says to Joseph, you do stand in for me here, give my son a name, be his father. And he calls him Jesus. What a story, hey? And the reason I wanted to take it out of context of our church calendar is because I think we can miss some of this. So let me try and wrap it up for you as we remember this passage. Next slide, please. First thing, God has a plan, and there's nothing, not people, not powers, not traditions, not anything that can stop it. God knew this day would come. He told Isaiah about it. And so we can rest secure, even in the things that we're longing for, that God has got all of this, even when it doesn't seem like he does. And even when it seems like he doesn't answer our prayers, the biblical witness is, just because he hasn't acted doesn't mean he's forgotten. It just means his timing is different to your timing. So keep praying. Jesus would later sleep in the storm. Do you remember that story? He's out in this massive storm, is threatening to take over the boat, and the fishermen who've been at sea all their lives are terrified. It's that bad a storm. And yet he is so totally given to the peace of God because he knows that his Father has got this. The journey to deep peace, I think, involves us coming to peace with the fact that we often, or maybe mostly, do not have a clue. We miss so much and we stumble, but it's okay because God has got this. And whatever you're holding tightly today, God has got this. We know from the Bible that this moment of an announcement of a new baby coming immediately was part of a big plan that also included all of Jesus' earthly ministry and the calling of his disciples and the cross and the resurrection and the ascension and the coming of the Spirit at Pentecost, leading to the birth of the early church and the church throughout history, all the way through in the future to his second coming, his judgment and his new creation and Eden restored. That's the bigness of God's plan, which should encourage you because it holds all the little details in it that you long for too. And also remember at this time when the world seems to get more and more chaotic and more fragile, no matter how hard life gets or chaotic life seems or how broken the world gets, no matter who is president or who is prime minister, God has a plan. And nothing, not the insecurity of Herod or the might of Rome, could do anything about it. So here's our big idea, next one for you. Our security doesn't have to rest on our circumstances or our need to be in control or the size of our bank balance or whatever it is else that you want to lean on to make yourself feel peace-filled. That's why when Emmanuel comes, God with us, he says, it is me. Do not be afraid. And that's how Mary, we read her beautiful song in Luke 1, is able to be at peace, I think, even when all of the human evidence and cultural evidence around her suggest that she should rightly be panicking right now. So be at peace, my friends. God has got you, and he's got me, and he's got all of this. As you read the news, do not be afraid. God has got it. But there's more. Next slide, please. He wants us to join him in longing or anticipating his plan coming to fruition. The prophets and many others long for God's plan to unfold. And I don't know if you remember this beautiful, I'll just get my Bible out here. In Hebrews 11, this is this amazing tribute to the people of great faith. Just get the right version of the Bible up here for me. Hebrews 11, verse 13, if you'd like to note the references. And it's been talking about Abraham and Sarah and Noah and Enoch and other people of great faith. And it says this, that all of these people were still living by faith when they died. Living by faith, it could almost be reworded as living with God's longing. They were longing for what God longed for, even when they died. They did not receive the thing that was promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting they were foreigners and strangers on earth. So, part of following God is about what longing what he longs for. And when the time is right to go with God's plan, when it has come to act. So I encourage you, if you have a godly longing, maybe you long for a loved one, or as we said, maybe you long for somebody's healing or your own healing. Maybe you long something for the more for the community of Gibsons. You have an imagination of what it would look like if God was worshipped and adored, and if the Spirit came and convicted people of their need for Jesus. How would that transform this community of the Sunshine Coast, or maybe of this nation? Whatever God has placed on your heart that feels righteous, maybe you long for justice for the oppressed. And maybe you've longed for these things for a really long time. I want you to be encouraged, because he isn't done. He does have this. And if his timing seems unfathomable, or the pain is great, or you're just flat out frustrated, don't give up, because he is still in charge. And like many Jews at this time, Mary and Joseph longed for God to come. And when he did, his coming was a shock, but they still welcomed him. And in Psalm 37, as it says here, there's this lovely verse that says, he will give you the desires of your heart. And I misread that for years, thinking it was a kind of prosperity gospel verse. If I long for something, he'd give it to me. And I think that's a misreading of the text. What it means is, he will put longings in you that you long for the right things. So if you're not sure what to long for, pray this verse and say, Lord, you said you would give me desires in my heart. May I long for the things that you long for. Because that's part of the posture of the people of God, is to long for the longings of God. But sometimes we don't know what he's up to. So I think, next visual please, we're nearly done. Let's ask God to speak to us. And let's also ask for the discernment that Joseph shows to know that it's God's voice when he speaks. Because it isn't always God's voice when we think it's God's voice. Right? Sometimes it can be our own conscience or our own insecurity. Sometimes it can be the voice of somebody else. And we need to discern well, is this God or is this something else? But let's ask God, and I do mean this, let's ask God to speak to us. If you're feeling bewildered, ask him to speak to you. Yes. Brenda, as you head towards your big meeting on Tuesday, let's ask for God to speak to Brenda and be present. Right? Let's ask for the eyes to see and the ears to hear, and let's be bold. In Joel, which is an Old Testament prophet that Peter references on the day of Pentecost, and he says, it will be like this in the old times, the Spirit will be outpoured, and your young men will see visions, and your old men, listen to me, your old men will dream dreams. Don't forget that passage. Just because you're older doesn't mean that God's done with you. He's got a particular place for you, and you're to be the dreamers of his dreams. So let's be bold and ask. And as this year goes on, I do actually want us to start together actively asking God to answer this question. What is your plan for this town and this coast, and how do you want us to be involved? I am interested in what you long for, but I'm particularly interested in what God is calling us to. But more on that after the summer. We're going to start an active process of discerning together, nearly fell off the stage there, sorry about that, discerning together what God wants us to do and what he's at work in doing. And it may be, and this story reminds us of that, that when we think we know what God is doing, we should be careful, because sometimes what he's up to is very different to what we expect. Nobody expected this story, right? So one of the postures of discernment and of longing is to say, Lord, I don't know. Would you show us? And would you show us together that we would have unity and understanding what it is that we're called to do? So it's not the pastor's vision, or it's not the elder's vision, or it's not one particular dominant person's vision. It's our vision because God has given it to us collectively. Does that make sense? That's where I want to go with this. Next one, please. Yeah. And it may be surprising, folks. It may not be what we expected. Next one. And this is the last piece. And when we have discerned, let's be obedient to act. Let's not rush to act because we need to discern first. And that's why doing life together is so important, because it's really valid to say, I have this sense. Eve, I've got this sense from God, and I just want to share it with you and try this out with you. What do you think? And you might say, I don't know, I'm going to go and pray about that. That's the kind of thing we should be doing for each other. Yeah? Help each other in this journey of discernment. So friends, welcome to the beginning of the Jesus story. Kings and screw-ups. Unexpected surprises and shocking revelations in ordinary, forgotten places. And we're only in chapter one. Next week, we're going to meet some wise, stargazing kings from a distant land. And after that, a terrible, terrible persecution. This really is the story of all stories. Not just because of what happened back then, but because it has relevance right now. So will you join me in weeks to come as we go through this?